real reason I needed to get away from London was that I hated my creative partner. Obsessively so. I remember one day standing with one of those big, long, beveled-edged rulers they use for cutting card with a scalpel. It's basically a blunt sword. He was standing there to my left. Suddenly I felt faint. I didn't fall over or anything. I just checked out for a few seconds. I saw a kind of yellow mist. When I came back, I was terrified I'd look down and see him lying there with his head smashed in. This was the day I stuck my head out the window and called the headhunters. I was afraid of what I might do if I stayed working with him. And it was better to leave the country than to worry about meeting him in the bitchy streets of London. Or maybe I just needed a change. Newly arrived in my new country, my new city, I wasn't interested in girls. Not in the least. When I think about the chances I missed, I just want to sob. A foreigner like me in the Midwest really stands out. Mind you, I did ask one gorgeous girl out, but she said she was going steady, so I thought, fuck it, if I can't have a beaut, then I'm not playing. The other thing was, of course, that I didn't want to get stranded there with two kids and a dog. I knew from the moment I landed that I'd have to get out. I thought a year would do it. I was wrong. I bought a house, but that was just to convince them I was serious. A house was easy to sell in a buoyant market. And if I played my cards right, I'd make some money on the fucker. And anyway, when was I ever going to be able to afford a Victorian house with hardwood floors and a cute swing seat on the veranda like the house in the Waltons? The agency talked to the bank to help me get it. The house was great, for about a month. In the meantime, I was getting to know the insides of airports pretty well. In America, taking a flight is like taking a bus in England. You get on a plane for a meeting, especially if you're based in St. LaCroix, Minnesota. The first job they put me on was a huge project overseeing the commercials for the car company BNV Linkup with the Sean Penn movie Tomorrow Forever Cries. Their new model, the 9T, was being featured in the movie, as was their new motorbike, the T2600 Surfer. They wanted three commercials and three print ads to announce this highly attractive association of icons. It was a pain in the arse. You had to feature the car prominently and show clips from the movie. Very difficult task. Very difficult to get a nice clean idea while having to include all those separate elements. Then on top of that, we had to deal with three different clients. BNV North America, BNV Germany, and DGR Pictures. It took nearly 9 months and three times as many flights to get the bastard finished. In my office, on the 27th floor of an ominous grey skyscraper, looking out on the flatness of the Midwest, stretching for hundreds of miles in every direction, I might just as well have arrived on the moon. It reminded me of a sci-fi program on BBC called Space 1999. There were a lot of similarities. The interiors of the moon base were all clean lines and high-tech, and the views out the windows were barren and stark. The inhabitants of the base were all hand-picked, highly civilized, and above all, disciplined. This was a big thing at Killallen Fitzpatrick, the ability to smile while under duress. They loved that. They liked you to suffer quietly. And I got pretty good at it. I was 5 years sober. This was what I had stopped drinking for. This was the kind of thing I would never have been able to do. I mean, on paper, it was great. House, job, money, move to the States. When I was drinking, there was no way I would ever have been offered this kind of situation. And I congratulated myself that I hadn't fallen into the trap of having a girlfriend, because I would never have been able to go if I had. I resolved to resist any advances by any girl from anywhere in the Midwestern region. I was no fool. I was not going to let myself get stranded for the rest of my life with some gorgeous wife and blonde kids as Killallen Fitzpatrick slowly turned up the heat until I cracked like spring ice. I got myself hooked up with the local AA groups, which were great. I began to feel better. St. LaCroix is the capital of rehab. They have more rehab centers than anywhere else in the States. This was one of the reasons I felt so comfortable about moving there in the first place. Less comforting was my discovery that right next door to the biggest of these treatment centers, there is a bar. Inside that bar, there is a sign. It reads, AA chips exchanged. For every year you stay sober, you receive a little metallic coin called a chip. This bar offers free booze for one night to any lapsed member of AA willing to spend his chip. The wall behind the bar is covered with chips. As long as I didn't drink and didn't get into a relationship, I'd be able to get back to London and resume life and look back on this whole period as an interesting lapse in concentration. Either way, I was looking out my window after having been flown over and paid quite a bit. I was making $300,000 a year. My ego had been fluffed to the point of ejaculation. My favorite pieces of furniture had been carefully packed and shipped. My mother had been sent a huge bouquet of flowers sympathizing with the loss of her husband, my father. The unspoken, unwritten expectation hung over me. Okay, big shot. Let's go. That was pretty freaky, but I didn't mind because I was in a good position. If I fucked up, it didn't really matter. I was in a foreign country. If I did well, it just meant their trust was well placed. And of course I'd make sure the folks back in London, England, knew all about it. So I came home to my big Victorian house in the evenings after my AA meeting, and I liked the fact that I hardly had any furniture. It appealed to me to be living in a house with just a few bits and pieces. The scarcity reminded me of a Deep Purple album cover that featured pictures of a huge country house in France with recording equipment and wires and cool-looking fuckers strewn everywhere. This was the effect I strove for. But no one else appreciated the irony of a mostly empty house owned by a shaven-headed Irishman who didn't seem responsible enough to have been given a mortgage. This amused me. It would not have seemed unnatural if someone had kicked in my door one day and said, "There's been a mistake. Get out." I would have left quietly because I really didn't think I deserved such good fortune. This was linked with feelings of guilt and shame over what I had been doing to people when I was drinking. This need to hurt was lessened when I stopped drinking. Maybe it was replaced with a need to hurt myself. My neighbors tried to welcome me, but they didn't understand I could never be seen with them voluntarily. It was okay if someone knocked on my door or invited me over for a beer, which quickly became a Coke. Irony could be achieved under these conditions. All this was fine until I was forced to borrow a lawnmower. American lawns are loaded with social and political meaning. There's a law somewhere that says you have to maintain your lawn, or the neighbors can force you to. I knew nothing of this and immediately reveled in the possibility of allowing my front and back gardens to return to nature. A polite knock on my front door changed all that. The polite knock has a lot to answer for in this world. There he was, frown on forehead, hand on heart, leaflet in hand, the state of Minnesota personified. "Morning." "Oh, hi," I said, feigning surprise after watching the fat fuck trespass his way to my front door. "I was noticing how you were having some trouble with your lawn care, and, well, I think you might find this leaflet interesting." The lazy pronunciation of words like interesting is code for informality. Saying interest in instead of interesting is their way of announcing they are just regular guys. "Oh, thank you very much. That's really very kind of you," I said, drawing on 10 years of Britishness that lay in reserve for moments like these. Very humbling, though. The lawnmower I borrowed from yet another neighbor had a full tank of gas, and even I knew it would need to be returned full. Such a task would entail a conversation with a gas station attendant. "You're not from around here, are you?" Every time. I'd change my accent, flattened a little. I could pretend I was from New York or Los Angeles. At least they wouldn't feel as if they'd landed such a catch. If you said you were Irish but from London, it was as if one had performed a method of fellatio so bizarre that their eyes would glaze over and a little happy smile would bend the momentarily speechless mouth. Then the thanking would start. I represented every postcard, movie, or rumor that had ever emanated from Europe, and everybody knows ambassadors need to be diplomatic. I'd just pick up whatever I'd been trying to buy and leave. I hated them. Forgive me, but I fucking hated them. When I got back to Ireland for a break at Christmas, I couldn't even look at a McDonald's sign without wanting to spit. I'm all right now because I live in New York. Thank you, God, for New York. But the Midwest is something else. My boss used to point at girls who had just joined the agency and whisper, "She's single." I couldn't believe it. He actively encouraged me to go out with girls who worked for the agency. The theory being, of course, that if I married within the company, then the company would live forever. And then I might even have kids. Or he'd say, "You come in on the bus, don't you?" "That's right." I met my wife on the bus. For fuck's sake. He was a decent enough sort of guy. I don't think he did it cynically. He just seemed to have bought the whole package. Advertising is false. Once you know that, you've got a chance. But he believed the hype. The wife, the house, the kids, the dog. I think he was good at what he did and a great boss. He just didn't have enough suspicion. I am, of course, aware that hearing this, you could conclude that any unhappiness I experienced was homemade, that my suspicion of my boss's good intentions was in itself the problem. But it's what I do. I suspect. It's the other stuff I find hard, like trusting people. Foreign concept. Just ask any of the billions of girls I haven't dated. So the boss had his motives and I had mine. I just wanted to get Killallen Fitzpatrick on my resume for 1 year. That was it. A year. I was panicking after 3 months. If I hadn't just moved into the house, I'd have left right then and there. So I suppose it worked out for the best. Anyway, it took almost 2 years before I got out, but that's not what I want to talk about. I mentioned all that stuff about advertising only to give you a background against which to project the rest of my story. The real point is to tell you how I purged myself of my sins against women, and indeed against myself. They say that you're not punished for your sins, you're punished by them. Also, I'm completely paranoid. I mean seriously paranoid. Not just mildly interested in the fact that there may be people who don't necessarily have my best interests at heart. No. The word is paranoid. Another word is self-centered. I don't like that one as much, though. It doesn't sound medical enough. The paranoia is worth mentioning because it sometimes fuels my crazy thinking. Like the time I thought Penn was paying people to follow me. Why she was doing this is not totally clear. My paranoia gives me only broad scenarios. It's too lazy to go into details. I believe that people, ordinary people on the street, were operatives in her employ. Their mission was to disrupt me psychologically. Every time I left my basement flat in Camberwell, an old lady or a man with his daughter became enemies I had to avoid. I would wear an expression that in my poor, confused mind exuded the following statement. I know who you all are. I'm going to give you the impression that I don't know, just so we can keep this charade going. But in truth, I know, so don't push it. You may wonder what this expression looks like. I'll tell you. Cocky anger. A snarl with a slight smile. Imperceptible, but there. I know, you know, I know, recurring to infinity. Of course, the fact that I've told you all of the above does slightly dent my credibility concerning the below, but my only obligation here is to relate what happened. This is my therapy. I'm too fucked up to go and see a therapist, and to be honest, I wouldn't trust him anyway, would I? I mean, it's not as if my paranoia is going to clock off for an hour a week, and I've got enough on my plate having to be a genius during the day and an AA leading light at night. I heard someone say somewhere that it's possible to write the sickness out of yourself. And who knows, maybe someone will benefit. Anyway, as I said, I live in New York now. I'm much happier, and even though the way I got here wasn't exactly graceful, I love it here now. It is amazing to me that I do. The first 2 months I spent in Manhattan were the nearest I ever got to suicide. It was funny how it came to me, the thought of killing myself. It had only been a week since Aisling rejected me in Georgina's, and somehow during that period I was able to do a decent impersonation of myself. You'd think it would have been easier considering I'd been my own understudy for years. Taking breaks to go outside and cry helped. So I found myself looking out the window on the 15th floor of the New York branch of the same agency I worked for in St. LaCroix. It was around the end of March and very humid. Nothing like as bad as it gets in July, but humid nonetheless. And much worse, because they don't turn on the air conditioning until summer. So there I was, gasping for air, a waft, a ripple of merciful breeze, when I looked down on the cement below. It was the back of the building, so I was looking down on those weird fans they always have in New York. Fuck knows what they are. But there was a little rectangular clearing of combed concrete in the center. Gently it came to me. Gently now. Not like some crazed jump cut that makes you blink. Calmly, I saw myself lying as if in REM sleep, perfectly framed in that rectangular area. Left leg bent, right leg straight, left arm bent with the palm of the left hand down, right arm straight down by my side. My head turned sideways on my left hand, as though asleep on a pillow. Just above my head and under my left hand, there appeared to be a very neatly arranged abstract area of red, like a big flattened flower upon which my head rested. Rested. I looked peaceful, beyond pain. I was in a lot of pain, you see, but it had been caused by an abstract blade. What I mean is, the pain was physical, the cause wasn't. I suppose some people would say I was suffering from a broken heart. Or you might say it's just life. Or maybe it's alcoholism minus the alcohol. After all, I'm 5 years sober at this point. True, but something else was going on. How do I know? I don't. I just can't believe that my emotional state could be explained by such an adolescent term as broken heart. I'm willing to be wrong, but I don't know how anyone would ever be able to prove it, so I'm safe enough. That's another thing you'll learn about me as we go on. I don't like to take risks. I'll offer you the possibility that I'm wrong, only if I'm fairly sure I'm right. Makes me appear more humble. For example, if I believe something I've thought of is funny, I'll pretend that someone else said it in order to get an unbiased reaction from the person I'm telling it to. If that person laughs, I congratulate myself on having come up with something funny, truly funny, because it achieved laughter from my acquaintance without feeling I'd be hurt if he hadn't found it funny. Where was I? Suicide, yes. Suicide comes like an old friend. I had just moved from Minnesota to be with the girl I loved, but that girl didn't exist. I couldn't find her anywhere. I could see her any time I wanted. I could talk to her day or night. She was very happy to be my friend. The ultimate demotion. The word friend registered as eunuch in my fevered mind. I could see her, but only as a non-man. Exquisite torture. And it was so hot. I had so much scary work to do. People to impress. Apartments to see. Ideas to generate. I had a strong sense that the world and its inhabitants were trying not to burst out laughing in my face. That they would do later when I wasn't looking. The thought came to me. You could use a rest. I felt myself nod at this. And then it'd all be over. No more pain. Cool air on the way down. It made sense. Especially the cool air on the way down. That was very attractive. Something stepped in and said no. I suppose I was kind of numb for a month or so after that, but that picture of myself framed on a gray mattress will stay with me forever. My paranoid Polaroid. That's one picture she definitely had a hand in. So, let's see. We've gone too far. Let's reverse a little. Right. I'm in St. Lacroix, and it's around August. My dad has died and now lives in the ground outside Deilford, in the corner of a churchyard near his own dad. Strange to think of that. I was alive and well and waiting for what everyone was waiting for in St. Lacroix, the winter. If you're smiling and brimming with fun and full of lip, some Lutheran type will savor the moment before saying, "You wait." They don't like happiness. Seriously, all that Swedish-Norwegian influence has the same effect as a big, wet, hairy blanket that freezes hard in the winter for at least 6 months. Fucking freezing. If you live there, the frozenness becomes relative. I felt a sense of elation if I woke up one morning and the asshole on the TV told me it was minus 17 degrees instead of the minus 30 it was the day before. I was ready to break out my shorts and sandals. To any sane person from the real world, it's still fucking freezing. Never before has the picture of a girl in a bikini brought forth such feelings of incomprehension in me. There, in an ad for holidays on the side of a bus, stalled in a snowdrift. Smiling and tanned, resting her head on one hand, she says, "You are a fucking idiot." As the bus crept past me, her lips actually seemed to move as she inquired, "Why are you freezing your balls off in semi-Siberia?" I would have cried, but my tears would probably freeze and blind me. I didn't know what tears did at these temperatures. How could I? I wasn't from here. I had no experience of this. I trained myself to derive a perverse pleasure from the surrealism of the place. Hell in reverse. Instead of fire and brimstone, it was snow and ice. There exists in Minnesotan myth a fabled phenomenon. At certain temperatures, somewhere in the minus 40s, a cup of coffee can be thrown in the air and it will crystallize before hitting the ground. I heard this at least 3 times before experiencing my first winter. The purpose, I suppose, of this little fact was to scare the fucking shit out of newcomers. It has a beautiful disguise built into it in the sense that on the surface it appears to be an interesting fact worthy of mentioning. It even has what we call in advertising a mnemonic. That is to say, it has one memorable thing you can bring away from it. the story would come under the heading of The One Where Coffee Freezes in the Air. It has that fact as a decoy for the storyteller. The storyteller can impart his tale in the guise of one who is merely sharing knowledge. The truth, though, has more to do with the satisfaction wrought from the face of the listener as he realizes just how fucking freezing it must be for a cup of coffee to turn into crystals in midair. Then he has to decide whether to react honestly, blanch and throw up, or dishonestly, feign interest in the actual physics. One particular night, my Victorian house had a bed, a table, a hi-fi, and a Texas friend in it. I mention what state he's from only because it removes any authority you might attribute to him concerning his knowledge of all things fucking freezing. "Dude, it's minus 35 outside. Let's try that coffee deal." "It's not cold enough," I said. Fearful of having to make coffee and demonstrate my ignorance of the coffee maker, which I had never used and only had because someone gave it to me as a moving-in present. "Dude, with wind chill, it's plenty cold." "Well, I don't want to make coffee. I don't think I have any." "Dude, water'll do fine. Boil some water." What the hell? I was bored listening to how great Texas was anyway. I had saucepans, believe it or not. And before you could say, "Remember the Alamo?" we had a saucepan of water on the boil. "Dude, wait till it's bubbling. It's gotta be bubbling. Otherwise it won't work." And bubble it did. The kitchen opened onto the back garden and there was a couple of steps down to it. I opened the mosquito door, which I had learned to keep shut at all times, even in the winter. You can't take chances with those little bastards. Then, after stepping into my carefully shopped-for goose-down, all-in-one, duvet-cum-flak jacket, for all intents and purposes a flexible shed, I opened the kitchen door and eyes with. Tex's ass was having none of it. In just a t-shirt, he grabbed the saucepan handle with both hands and, careful not to spill anything, motioned the steaming pot towards the night. I pushed the door open wide and flicked on the outdoor light. Well, fuck it. If it was true, I didn't want to miss it. So out he went to the top step. It looked like there was smoke coming out of the saucepan now because of the contrast between hot and cold. He had the pan in both hands in front of him. He said, "Dude," one more time just because there was an opportunity to, and leaning back, he flung the contents into the black sky. There was a little glint among all the steam, and then an almighty roar. He looked directly ahead and shuddered. At first I thought he was cold, but then I realized it was the other way around. The boiling water had gone up and then down, landing on him. Far from crystallizing, the water only cooled slightly, and this fact alone saved him a trip to the hospital. Funny how quiet it gets when there's 4 feet of snow and everything. How surreal to step out of my house on the morning and find myself on the set of Dr. Zhivago. The hairs in my nostrils went hard, and if I tried to pick my nose, they would break. The air hurt my lungs. I could feel the weight of it in my chest. I may have had a funny hat on, but I had better have those ears covered. Extremities were the first to go. Ears, fingers, toes. That's what you always hear about Captain Scott types having their toes bitten off. You need those funny hats with the flaps. Oh, yes. The winter doesn't just degrade your physical sensibilities. It assaults your sense of taste with equal fervor. But the purifying effect of cold, sterile air was somehow comforting. It allowed a conspiratorial sloth to envelop the soul. Conspiratorial because others would assist you in the postponement of life. For that is what it was. I said to myself, well, nothing can be achieved in this. The weather is so inhospitable, there's no point in starting a new project till the weather improves. Which I ended up hoping would be never. You'd be in the right place with such hopes. People get so fat in Minnesota winters, they couldn't go out, which in turn contributed to their getting even fatter. They had constant supplies of food delivered to their door. The snowplows were keeping the roads open only to feed these fat fucks pizza. The snowplow drivers were not exactly svelte themselves. But you know what? You know, I'm trying to stop saying that. They say that a lot in Minnesota, you know what this, you know what that. To me, you know what should be reserved for something truly surprising. You know what? What? Fuck you. Anyway, I was going to say before I interrupted myself that I'd been prepared for the winter so much by every person I met that when it descended, it wasn't that bad. I was told I had two of the mildest winters in a very long time. I didn't mind. I didn't feel cheated. I can still say, hand on heart, that I weathered two fucking freezing Minnesota winters. I served my time. Combine my celibacy with my Arctic experiment, and you've got a potent cocktail of pent-up aggression and self-denial. I began to understand those who felt the urge to walk into McDonald's with an Uzi demanding satisfaction. Admittedly, if I had ever entered such an establishment with that kind of mayhem in mind, I'd be the kind of guy who'd refuse to turn the gun on himself. Much better to shoot yourself in the leg and pretend to be one of the victimized. That way, you got to see the aftermath on TV from a hospital bed. But wouldn't the other victims identify you? Not if you'd been careful enough to cover your face, they wouldn't. Okay, so I've thought about it. 1 year in Minnesota felt like three. I owned a Victorian house in one of the best neighborhoods in St. Lacroix. By this time, I'm making $300,000 a year, my mortgage has risen to $4,500 a month, and I'm stressed out of my mind. My salary gave me about twice what I needed to pay the monthly mortgage, so I could afford it, but even so, I'm not rich. I thought I'd be rich. I anticipated being nonchalant about money. Having expensive toys like jukeboxes and sound systems and pool tables and bubble-wrapped antiques? No. But hang on, I was going to make a fortune when I sold the house, wasn't I? Yes, of course I was. Now get back to work. I was convinced that every $4,500 I gave to this Victorian was like putting money in the bank. Nope. Suitably enough, considering the temperature outside, all I succeeded in doing was freezing the loan in its tracks. Nothing was being paid off, except the interest and the insurance. Basically, I was only paying the rent on the loan. And of course, I didn't make anything like a fortune on that whore of a house when I eventually did sell it. I sort of, almost, after tax rebates, broke kind of even. Barely. So in retrospect, it didn't hurt as much as it might have. But at the time, I had a house tied around my neck, a determination not to touch anything that might lead to contact with a female of any species, let alone human, and a desire to get back to London so strong I could taste it in the air around me. I waited for the Observer like a wino waiting for opening time. My sadness when the magazine was sold out or just didn't arrive because of, wait for it, freezing weather, was incommunicable. And when it was in, I'd clutch it to my chest. It was already 3 days old, but so what? I loved the clever, laid-back, almost bored-with-themselves way the writers put across their points. I never realized just how urban I really was. Moving from London to St. Lacroix was more of a shock than moving back to Ireland would have been. I found that out soon enough when I spent a few nights in New Dublin. It was so vibrant and young on that Christmas Eve, I had to hold back tears because I knew I would soon have to go back to Minnesota. The Observer, Time Out London, in fact anything from London, I loved those publications. Typical homesick behavior, I suppose, but I tipped my imaginary hat to the Observer, especially for its part in saving the patrons of McDonald's and other Minnesota eateries from a messy end. Also films. French films. Yes, I had a DVD player. I don't anymore. All I have to do these days is take a leisurely stroll up Avenue A and I've got all the entertainment I need. But back then it was like droplets of moisture on the cracked lips of the dehydrated to see a French film. Not just because the French, God bless them, make great films, but to see those old streets and buildings and that weather all damp and moist, Jesus Christ, I loved looking at that. I even took photographs of paused scenes at certain points. This was during my second year in Minnesota when I had really begun to lose it. I still have the photos somewhere. I needed to keep connected with Europe any way I could. My biggest fear was that I would end up accommodating expressions like, "You betcha," and "You're darn tootin'" into my vocabulary. So with my French films, Claude Lelouch was my favorite director, my English newspapers, and my Irish self, I kept the European flag flying in the ferocious Minnesota gales. 2 years. 2 years physically, but spiritually, it felt like eight. I trudged to the bus stop every morning through the new snow and crunched my way home in the evenings. Sometimes I'd walk around the lake, which was only 100 yards from my frosted front door. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Steady. One of the most telling symptoms of hypothermia against which one must be constantly vigilant is hallucinations. The imaginary attraction of what was before you. I'd tell myself, you've got a great job, a great house, the people are really nice, the girls are gorgeous, etc. I should have loved it. You'd have thought a 34-year-old unmarried man heading out there and finding himself surrounded by such conditions would be thanking his lucky stars. But I was cursing myself for having created these circumstances. If it had been happening to somebody else, I would have approved and even wished him well. But because it was happening to me, I couldn't bear it. It was as if I had been miscast in my own life. If I saw someone across the street who did the things to me that I routinely do to me, I'd run in the opposite direction. But I can't, can I? I'm married to me. And from what I could see, marriage to other people was the norm out there. I didn't drink or smoke, and I was fairly well behaved, at least outwardly. I should have been the perfect candidate for some self-respecting, clean-jeaned Minnesotan girl. But fuck it, the big toothy smiles, the thick, needy niceness, that crazy wide-eyed stare, I still don't know what that is. Zoloft? Stupidity? In New York, everyone just looked hurt. It seemed more honest. Maybe I just identified with them. So I decided I'd had enough of this. I'm gone. This before my first year was over. I picked a real estate agent for one of my AA meetings since I didn't trust the people who sold the house to me. I truly believe my former real estate agents would pick up the phone and call the company I worked for and tell them I wanted to sell my house. They had invested a lot in getting me to Minnesota, after all, and might be interested to hear why I wanted to leave after only 12 months in their employ. I offered this statement in defense of my paranoia. It wasn't until I actually physically tried to leave that I found out how hard it was going to be. The house did not receive one offer. Over that whole summer, nobody made me an offer of any kind. Can't tell you how terrified I became with every passing day, the summer ticking away, the winter approaching, and the possibility of another year in exile. Nothing sells in the winter. Sleepless, I would sit bolt upright in the bed. I'd curse the walls that surrounded me, and yes, I would cry, big, gasping, self-pitying sessions of sadness. I don't think anyone ever saw me, or at least I hope not, but sometimes I would end up on my hands and knees. It was the only position where I could breathe. Sometimes I'd end up laughing from relief. The job was very demanding too, so I don't suppose that helped. In fact, work was a lot of the problem. Knowing I wasn't going anywhere with that house tied around my neck, they gently applied more and more pressure. It would take at least a couple of months to sell a house. Therefore, they were comfortable giving me some of their toughest accounts. I wasn't going to resign in the middle of anything, or if I was, they'd get plenty of warning. The more the pressure built, the more I wanted to sell the house. But the fucker didn't budge, and I even started to lower the price on my real estate agent's advice. I wasn't too fond of him by the time we were finished. Coming home to what was a very cute house and cursing him and it, but mostly myself, for buying it. His advice to me was to dress it, in effect, give the impression someone lived there. Someone normal. So I borrowed furniture, the kind of stuff that would make it look like a middle-aged woman lived there. I tended the garden, installed flowers for every open house, mowed the lawns, became the very thing I relished not being in order to sell that whore of a house. But it wouldn't budge. One night, I returned home after refusing to go to the company Christmas party. Somehow they had arranged to have two ice sculptures placed on either side of the path to my door, big cylinders of ice with candles inside. Quite nice, really. I kicked them both in. To me, these homely sculptures represented the fact that I wasn't safe from their prying eyes, even in my overpriced fucking house. I was in a bad way. So I'd come into work and do the best I could. I did good work. But nothing I conceived ever got through. I couldn't help thinking that all they really wanted was to mine ideas and lob them into the communal conceptual pool from which the lifers could draw. Lifers were their favorites. The ones who would never leave and so were never expected to come up with their own ideas. Loyalty rewarded with stresslessness. They were usually married with kids and a house and so weren't going anywhere. They constantly needed new flesh to feed on. And they got it. Fair enough, once you knew the rules. Pretty scary if you bought the party line, which stated, "We love all our people. You are part of our family." Made me want to go and wash. My whole raison d'être was not to become a lifer. Have you ever seen a movie called The Firm? That's what it was like. A company that knew your every move and controlled you. Everything was fine until you went against their teachings. By the way, I fully accept that a lot of what I'm saying here is paranoia. All of this and everything that follows could well be my own imaginings and totally unfounded. I mean, the actual facts and figures are true. Dates, salaries, locations, awards, etc. But the motivations and emotions, even the existence of some of the people surrounding those solids, are smoke. I was working for a very weird but brilliant company. I didn't care because it was interesting to be in the States, even if it was only Minnesota, and it was beneficial to me because Kilallen Fitzpatrick had a reputation for producing fantastic award-winning work. Even if I didn't get anything produced, it was more exciting than sitting in London doing the same stuff I'd been doing for years. I won't pretend that I enjoyed it at the time, but now that I'm sitting here in the East Village, extricating myself from London and moving to the States was a great thing to have done. Anyway, well into my second year there, my fourth year off the booze, I was still refusing to get involved with any female. My favorite masturbation technique was to take a nice hot bath, soap up my baldy lad well and truly, then give him a good old beating. At one stage I was going to write a screenplay all about my right hand, a love story. There would have been scenes where I let my hand brush against my thigh as a precursor to hitting on myself. I'd blush. In another, my right hand would get jealous of my left. Many's the evening I rushed home to make passionate love to myself. Storing away the beautiful asses of the secretaries during the day, I'd mentally combine them into one composite perfectitude of buttockness. It worked. As you can see from the previous pages, it didn't have any perverse effect on my mental or spiritual state. If anything, another room full of McDonald's patrons was spared the inconvenience of drawing on their medical insurance. Also, I was saved the heartache of having to spend 14 years married to some woman of Swedish extraction who would need to be paid by my company to marry me in the first place. Imagine all those ice sculptures on my driveway every Christmas. I'm shuddering here, and it's August. Suffice it to say, much masturbation took place during this Minnesotan period. You know, anyone listening to this would be forgiven for thinking, what's wrong with this guy? What's his problem? He lands a cool job in the States, and all he's done since the beginning of this is whine. Let me just say this. I'm whining in retrospect. At the time, I never whined. Not once. I was the picture of humility and gratitude. Oh, thank you. Oh, no, thank you. Coming in the weekend? Of course. I'm not doing anything anyway. I don't even have a girlfriend, so there's no danger of anything like that getting in the way of your requirements. You don't like that concept? Of course you don't. It's weak. I should have known better than to present it to you. I'd all but reverse out of the room bowing. I had to. I was in no position to bargain. With a $4,500 a month mortgage and no green card, I needed not to piss anyone off. Jesus, as I look back on it, it's even more scary than I let myself realize. Funny that, when things are dodgy and I don't like the way they're going, I move into just-for-today mode. It's an old AA trick for staying off the booze. I don't have to do whatever it is forever. I just do it today. It makes even the heaviest shit bearable. But then later, when I look back and see just how heavy it was, I exhale. But hang on, I have to tell you about something that happened the first Christmas after Dad died. Remember now, I've been in Minnesota only 4 months, and I won't meet Aisling till the following November. My mother and I were sitting in the kitchen sizing each other up. We were both in shock. Her from the fact that her husband of 40 years was suddenly missing. She told me she had a dream where they were on holiday and she couldn't find him. And me, from losing my father and having been uprooted to live in the Arctic. A roasted turkey with no legs was steaming in the space between us. It was the first time my mother had bought a turkey on her own, and it had seemed like a bargain to her to buy the one that had no legs. It was considerably cheaper than the able-bodied version. After all, she had spent a lifetime having a man to deal with all financial matters, so now the cost of living had become urgent. The turkey steam softened our image of each other that Christmas. Later, during that visit, I was doing the chair at the local AA meeting in Deelford. Doing the chair meant a member told his story, how he drank, how he stopped, what it's like now. At smaller meetings, they got tired of hearing the same people again and again, so when someone came home on holiday, they were often asked to speak. It was my turn that Sunday. Amongst the regular attendees, many of whom I'd gotten to know quite well over the years, was a very young, well-dressed, blonde-haired girl, slender, tall, elegant, definitely stood out, could have been a model, probably was. I tried not to embellish my story too much for her sake. I began telling the assorted morning circle about how I used to enjoy hurting people, girls in particular. I touched on the pleasure I got from it, the pleasure I felt when they reacted with such abhorrence, the need I had to hurt. Not unlike some of the stuff I've shared with your good selves, but in a more general way. I went on to say how I now believe this behavior was linked to my alcoholism, and that I didn't feel the need to do it anymore, and that I still felt like I owed amends to every one of those girls, but that the AA way was not to go back to places where we might cause even more pain. The best amends I could make was to stay out of their lives. I had no right to go back and make their load heavier just to relieve mine. After I finished my talk, the blonde-haired girl came up and thanked me. Standard procedure. But she said some things that didn't sink in until a year and much turbulence later. She said she had a friend who liked to do what I'd been talking about, only she did it to men. The kinds of things I described were very similar to the kind of thing her friend got up to. She said this friend lived in New York now, but was originally from Dublin, a photographer's assistant. And if I ever met her, I should be very careful. I must have had my polite face on because she suddenly said, "She knows about you." This girl was obviously out of her tree. It happened a lot in AA. Someone came in for one meeting and you never saw him or her again. I hope this would be the case here. She went on to say she was staying with this so-called scary girl's stepdad that weekend in Deilford and that she'd needed an AA meeting because she couldn't handle the all-night parties. She feared for her sobriety. I immediately imagined satanic orgies going on in that guy's house and was even ready to hear some details until she mentioned his name, Tom Bannister. I knew the name very well because he had been my father's solicitor. In fact, when my father died, he had been so supportive and helpful that I asked him to keep an eye on my London flat. She had my attention now, but the significance didn't register, because there was nothing to react to. Later, much later, I remembered that 9 months before this encounter, when I was still working in London, an article had appeared in the Deilford Gazette, supplied and written by me, announcing my appointment as senior art director at Killallen Fitzpatrick. It was the kind of thing local papers loved. Deilford boy does well. I did it as much for my dad as anyone. He loved to brag to his friends about me. He even got a mention as the parent of the wunderkind, along with the school I attended and my hobbies. I put writing and music. And I couldn't help but include the fact that I was single. Well, why not? There might be a nice Irish girl out there reading it. Apparently not. Could Aisling have read this article during one of her visits? It would explain how she knew about me. "She's evil," said the blonde. She herself had apparently witnessed the awful effect this girl could have on guys. She looked at me for far too long, like I wasn't taking her seriously enough. I wasn't. I thought she was just some rich Dunleary type who'd overdone the coke and was an AA to keep her rich husband happy. Now I think she was trying to warn me. She took on an even more serious tone as she turned to me before leaving. "It's her eyes. That's what does it. They can't believe she could be so bad." I remember thinking it's a pity she's so fucked up because she's very tasty. But I could see that whoever she was talking about had certainly put the fear of God into her. So I thought no more about it. Why would I? There are a lot of people, some of them strange, some of them not, who pass through AA all the time. I never saw the blonde again. So off I go with a heavy heart back to the tundra that January. I made a pledge to myself that I would leave before the year was out. It was the second time I'd made this promise. It would take slightly longer. I was working on B&V. I was working on B&V only. It's tough when you're working on only one subject. You can't get any fresh air, so to speak. It's very tough when you're on it for almost 2 years. Also, it's very draining. At one point, I would resist even making a joke with my small circle of AA friends, because I feared the waste of creative energy would usurp my bank, and I'd be depleted when B&V came to make yet another withdrawal. Oh, yes. When you've been on it 4 weekends in a row, and there's no sunshine or vacation in sight, and you don't want to be in the country, let alone the office, it's important to refrain from spending your reserves. You may still have a long way to go. And although I promised myself I'd be out soon, my cautious side reminded me that I'd said that before. It was now February. 3, maybe 4 more months of frightening weather still to go. A combination of hiding behind the big broadsheets of the Observer and the warm glow of the TV screen, I somehow made it to spring, which lasted about a week, and then the summer was upon us and everything transformed. Where once there was a white sheet of paper, there now began to appear the most delicate crayon flicks of grass and leaves and bud and flower. And the girls. Unbelievable, Aryan examples of breast and thigh. Healthy to the point of insulting. Like well-trained troops circumnavigating the lakes on bikes, rollerblades, and of course on foot. The sexual infantry. I very quickly learned that they were married or about to be. snapped up early by canny investors. "Go ahead, leer," they'd scratch their noses or adjust their various straps, sending me a clear Morse message with the glinting rings. "No chance, pervert." Fair enough. The more beautiful and clear-skinned, the bigger and more blinding the glint. It was their fiancé's voice warning me by proxy, saving me time. How very Minnesotan. Polite. There also seemed to be a great deal of pride in the bulbous nature of a pregnant belly, a phenomenon I had not yet encountered. In London, pregnancy was associated with failure and social death. Here it was encouraged. People got promoted after having a kid. A little fleshy anchor prevented the minds of America's corporate soldiers from drifting too far from their assignments. Not the place for single males, especially single males from somewhere else. Summer in St. Lacroix is as hot as the winter is cold. Humidity makes the very air thick to breathe. All bared flesh becomes prey to the mighty mosquito, Minnesota's state bird. My first summer was worse than my first winter. At least I'd been forewarned about the winter. I had to make my own decisions about the summer months. Also, Victorian houses don't usually have that coveted air conditioning installed. It wasn't even invented until the 1960s or 1970s. How's that for an accurately researched fact? It's my humble opinion that a lot of the civil rights protests, and indeed a good portion of this fine country's problems, including the Civil War and the assassination of more than one president, can be attributed to the absence of air conditioning. You innocently open your windows in the hope that the breath of a wisp of a breeze of a wind will exhale itself into the airlessness that has become your life. Instead, you are prey to a procession of winged and world-weary insectoids trained in the art of psychological warfare. During the summer, these gaping mouths of Hades, disguised as windows, belched torture unheard of into my tepid home. I sought refuge in a bath full of cool water, but I needed to stay submerged for as long as lungs allowed. I could still be bitten on the face. I learned. Early evening was when I was at my most succulent to the winged carnivores. There are 10,000 lakes in Minnesota. That's a lot of humidity when it gets hot. Humidity means mosquitoes. There's a story going around. An elderly couple went camping. They'd been warned of the locust-like mosquito presence. They pitched their tent. They smeared themselves in what they believed to be mosquito repellent. They were both found dead. A can of mosquito attractant lay empty between the two corpses. The product was designed to be left outside the tent, thereby attracting the pesky critters away from your sleeping body. According to the story, the husband woke up, covered in bites, and said to his equally becratered wife, "Just imagine how bad it would be if we hadn't put on the cream, honey." No, I don't believe it either. But the summer had its moments. Alina was one of those girls with a caricature version of what a girl's body should look like. She was also a member of St. Lacroix AA and therefore more than qualified to attend the St. Lacroix annual barbecue. She was tanning herself on a little collapsible sunbed when her mobile phone roused her. Flicking it open, she squeezed out the following words in a voice at least three times higher than her IQ. "Hi, Jimmy. I'm just lying here toasting my buns. Wanna come flip me over?" She looked like Sophia Loren, juxtaposed on a Minnesota lawn. It was difficult not to attribute the sizzle from the nearby grill to her. Later that day, I masturbated furiously over this image in the coolness of my own bath. Oh, yes, I did. Summer, though, is not what we're here to talk about. Come September, things cooled down a little bit. It was the nicest time of the year. The leaves went all amber, and the air got fresh, and there was even the odd breeze. Oh, happy day. Along with it came another B&V assignment. I was sick of working on the account. The very sight of one on the street, I've never owned a car, made me wince. Still does. But that didn't matter. They'd spent all their money bringing me over to this fine country, and they wanted me working on B&V. With no offers on the house, I had no leverage, so I bit my scarred tongue and mumbled something about this being the last time I was ever going to work on this silly car account. They knew, and I knew, they were just nodding at me out of boredom. With a copywriter, I set to work on the project. Pretty soon we had something not half bad. Next, we needed a photographer. I took a notion, or the notion was gently introduced to me by clever account executives, that a still-life photographer called Brian Tomkinson would be an interesting change. Still life guys normally shot knives and forks and shoes and shit. Never or rarely cars. This, of course, made B&V nervous, but not for long. I did a sell on them with my Irish-English accent, and soon I was on a plane to New York with a whole week of shooting ahead of me. This is my favorite part about working in advertising. The shoots are superb, even the print shoots. You got a cool hotel, you got everything expensed, you get a week away, maybe more, from Minnesota. You got a half-decent shot for your portfolio. You got some time off from working on new concepts with which to feed the furnace. You got a breather. All I knew about New York was what I'd gleaned 5 or 6 years before during St. Patrick's Week. Basically, I was out of my fucking mind the whole week I was there, and it struck me as a miserable, dark, and dangerous place. This, however, was not the New York that greeted me now. 'Twas October, and autumn was having its way in what I soon learned was Soho. Beautiful to the eye, comely to the touch, mesmerizing in abundance. To the starved eyes of one such as I, there seemed to be an excess of muchness. Colors, smells, textures, nationalities, you've heard all this before. The studio was, still is, on Broadway, right on the lip of Soho, and the brow of the East Village, and the cusp of Nolita. I can remember being afraid to look, lest I increase the inevitable sadness of having to leave. I shopped. An unheard of luxury for me. Oh, they had shops in Minnesota, but in New York, no one asked where you were from. They just didn't give a fuck. God, I loved that. The shoot went well, and though I wasn't thrilled about the hotel they put me in, Tannery on 35th and Madison, not very nice, I was enjoying the porn channels. Why not? It was on expenses. And my hotel was changed after the first 3 days. So anyway, the initial shots of the car were done in a different part of town housing a bigger studio. I still couldn't tell you where that was. Not too far away from Broadway is all I can remember. So the next stage of comping needed to be done from Tompkinson's Broadway headquarters. Suited me. I turned up there the first day and was treated like a minor celebrity. Obviously they were just licking my arse, but it was hard not to enjoy it. I ended up criticizing how well they were doing it. Almost as if I was leaving my arse in the air and saying, "Excuse me, you missed a bit." Terrible, really. It was an unspoken thing. They knew, you knew, they knew, etc., recurring to infinity. So after a particularly successful day of having my arse licked, a young girl approached me nervously and said, "What part of Ireland are you from?" She heard me bragging I was Irish. "Deilford," I said, noticing how very pretty she was, if not a little young. I'd seen her around the place earlier, but naturally thought she was one of the many assistants photographers seemed to need. She was. "Oh, that's gas." I've only ever heard Irish people use that expression. "Are you Irish?" "I am, yeah, from Dublin." Well, I can't tell you I thought much of it, but I've retraced these moments many times since, looking for clues. Anything that might help me explain what the fuck was going on. She went on to say that there was a whole gang of us over here, and that if I wanted to, she could show me around. I really thought she was too young. Dangerously young, if you know what I mean. But after talking to her a little longer, I learned that her stepdad in Deilford turned out to be my father's solicitor. She was very pretty, very innocent-looking. The fact that she was Irish and had connections in Deilford, combined with the fact that her stepdad was Dad's solicitor, seemed to mean something. I allowed it to mean that she was sent by my dead father as a gift to redress the balance for the suffering I'd endured in St. Lacroix. This was a grave error. I wasn't conscious of wanting to shag her. I still believed her to be too young, but I thought I'd ask her to dinner as a treat. She was, after all, virtually related. And what would her stepdad think if he heard we'd met and I hadn't even offered to take her to dinner? She gave me her number, and out of sheer lack of knowledge, I booked a booth at the same restaurant Tompkinson had taken me to as his sociable statement a few nights before. Actually, I'd gone there with Thelma, too. Who was Thelma? Thelma Way was a gorgeous girl who worked at the New York office and invited herself to dinner with me when she saw me hanging around there. I never really thought there was ever any chance of getting involved with her on any romantic level. She was a great character, very beautiful, very tough. Aisling. That was the Irish girl's name. Yep, I liked it too. Gaelic for dream. It's haunted me since. So Aisling left a message on my hotel answering machine saying, "See you there." 3. She was about a half hour late, but she looked fucking lovely. Black V-neck sweater, black pencil skirt, black shoes. Very Prada. Long dark brown hair billowing behind her as she came through the door. She looked familiar, as if I'd known her before, like some sister I used to have and lost. So clean, young, and adult at the same time. From the moment she walked through the door, my biggest challenge was to hide from her how strongly she affected me. She came toward me with, I think, the intention of leaning to my left for what I was to learn was the obligatory New York peck on the cheek. Never heard tell of such a thing in St. Lacroix. Those eyes. This is going to sound awful, but I don't care. I'm way past embarrassment. You can't hurt a man with a pinprick when he's already got a spear in his chest. I swear to you that she looked just like the pictures of the Virgin Mary in Irish Catholic homes. I kid you not, the Virgin fucking Mary. You look great, I said, motioning towards the hostess stand. Thanks, so do you. That was her first lie. We strode into the arena, all brown leather and tea-stained tiles. This was Friday night. I was to fly back to you-know-where in the morning. It was quite busy, so we didn't get the booth. But we got a nice table. She was not stupid. That much was very clear, very quickly. This was no 22, 23, or even 24-year-old inexperienced bimbo. She talked older than she looked. I really was thrown by that. I was expecting to spend the evening deflecting compliments of such enormity that I would find myself hating her for her lack of subtlety. Instead, I ended up kicking myself for mine. And it was too late. I couldn't suddenly wake up and say, "Oh, I didn't realize you were intelligent. I thought you were a stupid fawning child, unworthy of my best game." She must have seen everything she needed to see in the first 15 minutes of my unbelievably self-centered diatribe. Slowly, almost considerately, she let me know how much I'd shown myself up. She'd already attended exhibitions I'd only begun to read about. Films I'd heard about were already memories to her. And I would never have realized that I'd mispronounced the names of all those foreign artists until she pronounced them. Her superiority was graceful, sympathetic even. Talk about being wrong-footed. Of course, I've since attributed every little nuance in that evening's conversation to her devilish manipulative skills. But the truth is, when somebody outshines me, I hide my anger by putting them on a pedestal. This makes me seem generous, so that when I want to put the knife in, I'll be trusted. Yes, sometimes I even scare myself. Anyway, she went on to tell me that she was from Whiteheath in Dublin. I found out much later that this is an extremely well-off area, and that she was an only child. She'd been assisting photographers on a freelance basis because it afforded her more time to devote to her own work between assignments. Forgive me, but I've always translated that to mean, I can't get a full-time job. All the while she was talking, I was falling totally and irrevocably in love. The long hands, the direct look, the head flicks commanding the soft tumbling hair, clear skin on her neck, the gentle slope of her small breasts. Stop. When she did appear impressed by something I'd said, I was now realizing I'd need to dust off my delf, so to speak. She seemed to notice me as you would a small boy. "Oh, really? Gosh, that's great." Or, "They must think a lot of you, and I wish I had your problems." From these reactions, I realized I came off like I was trying to impress her. I felt tricked into it. I wanted to start the whole evening all over again. And I couldn't help thinking she was bored but acting. She had a Bacardi and Coke during dinner, a big one. I had the pork chops. I still have the bill. I do. I got it back on expenses, but I kept the bill. You see, that night changed my life. If it hadn't been for that night, I wouldn't be sitting here in the East Village in New York writing this fucking thing. She said I'd like the East Village. She was right. But there you go. I fell totally in love with her. How could I not? My dead dad's gift to me and I was going to say no? No. We chatted easily about advertising and I generally tried to dazzle her as best I could. She was reserved but mannerly, very mannerly, old school. I'd never been allowed near that before. She even poured mineral water into my glass and twisted the bottle abruptly like you do with champagne. I got off on that. She was very attentive. That was it. She knew how to handle a guy. She made you feel like it was okay to be a guy, to be yourself. This, it seems to me, is the most devastating weapon of all in a woman's arsenal. If you can encourage the man to be himself, to reveal his character, his ways, then you know how to navigate him. and therefore he will never be able to hide from you. I already knew this. I've managed to stay in the advertising business for 10 years. That's one business that isn't known for its charity. And even I, Mr. Jaundice himself, entered through her velvet drapes and signed the waiver. Mind you, I was ready. I hadn't touched the woman in 5 years, for fuck's sake.